Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and reading with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
With the start of another school year, today we take a look at the 13% of public school students who struggle to learn in the same way everyone else learns and feel like a constant failure. When children struggle in school, they often feel shame that they are not normal. The term learning disability reinforces their belief and suggests that they are unable to learn. My guest today says that nothing could be further from the truth, and she calls these students unique learners. Suzanne Cresswell is an occupational and physical therapist who has worked with these unique learners for over 30 years. She provides solutions and strategies for parents and teachers and students themselves and helps them find the ability in learning disability. Suzanne Cresswell, welcome. In your book, you present learning disabilities that, I'm going to call them that because that's, I think, the term that most people will know.
Yes.
That went beyond what I suspected. When I hear learning disability, I think in school children, I think dyslexia.
Yes.
I think that pops to mind. Problems with reading because of that. Maybe autism.
Mm-hmm.
But you have so many more learning disabilities that I was unaware of.
Yeah. Well, learning is a very difficult activity developmentally, really. And many of our children are having challenges with the learning model. They're having trouble with their coordination, with the fine motor muscles, and having difficulty holding a utensil and writing. Then slows down the whole process for them. They have difficulty being able to follow the classroom structure and to stay up with the rest of their peers. Some children, if you look at them in the classroom, they're having difficulty actually finding the page number. The teacher's telling everyone to move to page 53, and you look at some of these students, and they're flipping back and forth, not really understanding sequencing. So, yeah, there's very many different variations of learning challenges. And for the most part, a way of working with these students helps to reveal their gifts and brilliance once we understand a way of working with the child and looking at the way that they are learning.
Yeah, because I, in my own head, thought, well, these learning disability has to do with the brain, and that's where it ends. And you were just talking about motor skills.
Yes, very much so. It's a connection between the brain and the body that is paramount for the children, especially the ones early in the school years. The movement that our body undergoes assists the brain in learning. We need to move in order for the brain to function well. It's how we're wired. It's how our brain sets up, where we will move our limb as an infant, and then the brain stores the information of the result of that movement, be it some favorable action like intentionally moving a rattle. And then that gets moved into a part of the memory, and then the child understands reaching and the space that it took to access the rattle, the amount of motion it required. Perhaps there's an auditory input, and all of these things are being staged in the brain. And the child gradually learns, augments that, practices again and again with their movement, and it's that back and forth between the movement, really interacting with the world, and how the world responds to that intention on the child's part, that is what learning is. That's how the child then gains information about themselves and their world, and then we can superimpose on top of that academic structures and so forth later in life. But yeah, at the beginning, movement is essential for the brain to function well.
My guest is occupational therapist and physical therapist Suzanne Cresswell from Reading. And her book is Unique Learner Solutions, Discover the Ability in Learning Disability. And just in case people don't think this is really serious, you provide a statistic from, it's actually from an article, recent article, from the University of Toronto. One in six women with learning disabilities has attempted suicide.
Yeah. Yeah, this is something that we're beginning to understand now. And we have appreciated the importance. We've started off maybe characterizing it as bullying, and this we're identifying when children are socially uncomfortable. We talk about social anxiety, and we talk about now teen suicide. And we're just really putting that together with these individuals who have these soft learning challenges, where they go through life having to really compromise in order to perhaps many times at adolescent and high school age, the fear is being discovered that you lack intelligence, lack cognition, lack the ability to get the grades of your friends and your peers. And really, in some level, any child worth their salt at this point in their life would be finding some kind of ulterior way to focus off that offensive ego concept that they lack intelligence and turn into the class clown, or they turn into the problem child, or they turn into that reticent, socially anxious child. And these are the kids in middle school and high school that we need to be looking at very closely, because they become more and more limited in their ability to deal with the world. And the consequences are very, very serious, actually.
Yeah, so just I'm going to repeat, 1 in 6 women with learning disabilities has attempted suicide. And that's also true. Men with learning disabilities also were more likely to have attempted suicide compared to men without learning disabilities. So that's rather shocking. I don't think people would ever attribute a learning disability to an attempted suicide.
Yeah, it perhaps it takes a little bit of a leap of understanding. But for me, in the work that I've been doing with the children and the adults with these various developmental delays and learning challenges and so forth, you can see how it may initiate as a child in the younger years, where they are just missing some of the salient details of what it is they're meant to be learning. For example, a child may have difficulty coordinating the small muscles of their body. We're talking about movement, and we think about physical movement. The small muscles of the body, we're thinking of the finger muscles for holding a writing utensil or an eating utensil. But the small muscles are also the oral aperture, the muscles that of mastication we chew with, and the visual muscles for visually tracking and discriminating. So the head must be still so the eyes can focus in, and then the fovea is able to track and discern, pick up from the page the vertical line versus the horizontal line, the space between the lines and the even greater space between the words. This is all very developmental and depends on our experience with movement in the past, our physical three-dimensional movement, for that to be stored in the brain. And then, as a child matures, they can represent that space in two-dimensional reading, writing, and arithmetic. So take the child who's, you know, in first and second grade is having trouble in PE and recess and has difficulty walking down the aisle of the desks without kind of bumping into his peers and rattling the desks and so forth. This is, you know, we're talking first grade, second grade, so it's a small pint-sized child, so it's not a big hip check. It doesn't really rattle the desk. But if you take that same child who's older and he's still bumping and crash, it's intolerable to the peers and the classmates, and it's actually the same behavior, but it's manifest in a child of larger stature.
That we think this child should know better now
more
by
mature.
Now. Yes. We don't cut this child any slack once he gets older.
So that child has an opportunity to make a joke out of it and kind of high five as he rattles the desk and slaps the guy, or maybe knocks the pencil over to be funny, or maybe knocked over and it was an accident, it wasn't intentional. And then the teacher would respond to that action, and the other peers would respond to that action. And then this child is kind of hemmed in this behavior of limiting himself or herself in being able to access the teacher's help and so forth, because the child and the adults very often in the child's life have already labeled this problem as being inattentive, a child who is disinterested and bored, and really that's often far from the case.
And I don't think people would think clumsy is related as a learning disability. The poor kid is clumsy. That has nothing to do with his learning his school subjects.
Right. Yeah, this is a distinction that is unfortunate sometimes, but the connection between our ability to move and navigate our body is a direct link to the ability of being able to read, write, perform arithmetic. For example, really mathematics, the numeral system is a symbolic representation of physical space. In mathematics, we're describing length, breadth, and depth. So you kind of have to know what that is inherently. What is length, breadth, and depth? You have to have that understanding with three-dimensional space with your own physical body. So developmentally, we'd be talking about this in infancy, the early twos and threes, where a child is experimenting with their body. Shape and size, peekaboo becomes a developmentally super fun game at that point because a child is aware they're too big to hide in a shoebox, but they might fit in the pantry. So they're getting to know their body's shape and size and that they can navigate an obstacle course so they can navigate through space. And then at around four or five, the child is able to sit still and visually plan. So the child doesn't need to physically navigate through the restaurant to the little boys, the little girls' restroom. They've had enough life experience that they could sit still at their restaurant table and visually plan. Okay, I'll go around where the fish tank is, and I'll go by the lady at the stand, and there's the restroom there. And they don't actually have to physically go and practice that with their body. They can and then you take the next leap to do that two-dimensionally using symbolic numerals and space and representing takeaway for subtraction and adding to it for addition. And all of these are languages that have to do ultimately with space. And space, to understand space, you need to be able to understand movement. And so it all harkens back to our ability to be able to understand how our body moves in a coordinated fashion.
Well, I want to go back 30 years. When you, as a young student, you decide you're going to be an occupational therapist or a physical therapist, did you know at that time what your career path would be, where it would lead you?
Well,
because you work in schools as opposed to, say, with a hospital.
Correct. Yeah. I do, actually. I think that I was always aware that I wanted to help and I wanted to make a difference, and it slowly started to slide into the ability to be the conduit between helping people understand why what they're seeing is occurring. So now that I work in the school systems, sometimes these children are looked at in a way that is less than productive in being able to problem solve the most functional approach toward educating them. And so I've been able to assist the teachers and the parents, for that matter, at our meetings in order to understand what is going on in the child so that we can look at the Rubik's Cube from a different perspective. Very often, we tend to look at human behavior in terms of just that behavior and the behavioral model of if it's an unfortunate behavior that we're trying to diminish, then there's consequences, natural consequences. And then there's also us socializing that individual by trying to extinguish the behavior through, you know, timeouts and stuff like that and lots of privileges and things like that. And through that behavioral design then, many children that have more typical wiring and a more typical approach to their educational model do very well with that. And then there's the other students that are gaining information in an entirely different way. And as the teacher or the parent, you will see that that same managing the child, parenting the child, educating the child, doesn't work in this particular instance. In fact, with this child, how surprising, the behavior actually gets a little bit worse as you attempt to rein it in. Because on top of the child struggling, let's talk about the child who just bashed into the desks. So the child's painfully obvious that he booshed into the desks and his peers pointing that out. And then he finally sits plop too loud, probably not controlling his descent, bam, into the chair or her. So this is an intelligent human who he or she is acutely aware of having been noticed walking in an unusual way. And they themselves are just trying to regroup and take a deep breath and calm down because they know their turn's going to come up perhaps in a moment to read aloud. They've got a lot going on inside. And then in addition to that, if there's an adult in the classroom passing judgment on them or causing them to have to explain for themselves why did they, you know, apparently intentionally bash into somebody's desk, if that child seems to regress and have difficulty with that, like, interaction and that cause and effect, asking the child to be responsible for, then very likely they have a they had a disconnect themselves. That, and then adding I'm trying to avoid saying punishment because I don't see teachers punish. I don't mean to say that, but in our society, parents and teachers will tend to loss of privileges or what have you. If there's a negative consequence, let's say that, to a unique learner, then it actually tends to accelerate the behavior. So the child would sit in his desk and maybe act up worse or start jiggling and making the desk jiggle and then not aware of it. And then the teacher's, why are you jiggling the desk? And it accelerates and then poof, the child's in the principal's office before anyone's really sorted out what's occurred. So it can deteriorate rather rapidly for these kids in middle school and high school that don't fully understand what is going on themselves with their learning challenge. But as a tip for the parent and teacher, if you've tried, try harder, quote, work harder, quote, you know, sit down, and these types of things that children with and adults with more typical wiring understand and respond to, if you've tried that and it seems to make the problem worse, then very often you'd be looking at a unique learner who needs different strategies.
My guest is Reading occupational therapist and physical therapist Suzanne Cresswell. She has written a book, Unique Learner Solutions, Discover the Ability in Learning Disability. One reason I ask about 30 years ago when you entered this career path was that I'm guessing you had to kind of invent the wheel, because I remember it's only fairly recently that we even knew that there were learning disabilities like dyslexia. We didn't have labels for these learning disabilities.
Yeah.
So who did you turn to for advice, or did you just have to figure these things out by observing?
Right. Well, there are the occupational and the physical therapy model tends to follow a developmental paradigm. So we're looking at human development basically from infancy on. And when we're looking at learning, as occupational and physical therapists, we're looking at how the child takes in information really right from very early in their life, right the way through, and how the brain begins to make sense of the world, really, when the child is first born. The child is in the, you know, womb, in a buoyant environment, feeling that buoyancy. And then once a child is born, it's really the first experience with the gravitational pull of the Earth's surface acting on the child's body. And the child then must be able to, first of all, experience that, process that, and then tell its muscles and joints what to do so it doesn't, its head doesn't stay down and suffocate. So when the child moves.
And this is something I wouldn't have connected learning disability and gravity.
Yes, yes. It's these things that happen right in the first few moments and days and weeks of infancy set up that child's brain ready for learning. And this is what we study in our occupational therapy and physical therapy background. So, and we can get to that if that is of interest to yourself or your audience. But to answer your question, so in the schools, being able to see that these students were having difficulty on these levels in terms of their ability to move and to coordinate their small muscles and their larger muscles and so forth, right at the get-go in working with the parents and teachers, looking at it from this different perspective, even 30 years ago, instantly seemed to get the adults to be able to brainstorm from a different perspective. It was just really, it was an experience of being a peace of mind that the teacher or the parent would say, okay, I got this. Now I see what is occurring. Okay, I got this. They've already got the experience and the intelligence and the background and the schooling and so forth that they knew what to do once the new paradigm was presented to them, that this is not a child who's walking down, hitting every single class, every single desk to annoy the teacher and the students, that this actually is a child who needs to feel, bash, where the side of my body is, bip, that's my hip, bop. And by the time they finally get to their desk, they've figured out their parameters and they are able to sit properly in their chair and so forth. But in the meanwhile, having created all this distraction as they go to sit down. But to answer your question, the teachers and the parents were always very interested in this developmentally, and the labels weren't as evident, you're right, but the people interested in educating and parenting well have found this information to be valuable right from the get-go.
And what you want parents, teachers, and the students themselves to understand, you talk about the systems, sensory systems, the vestibular system, proprioceptive system, and tactile system, that these systems work together. Mm-hmm. And why is it important that we understand these systems?
Yeah, well, it's important to be able to use language that we can all understand. And a lot of our research indicates that if we're talking about the same thing, if we're looking at the problem from the same perspective, then it is much easier to reach a decision and an outcome that has greater choice and variety and freedom for the individual. But to begin with the language, so that was kind of agonizing to make a book that I want to be easy read to discuss neuroanatomy, but I just couldn't stay away from the basics. So we've got the human sensory system, and we're all taught that, the five senses, taste, touch, smell, sight, and hearing. And point of fact, there's two other senses. We'll be taught them one day, but of course they're super long words. One is vestibular, V-E-S-T-I-B-U-L-A-R. And that's our ability to feel gravity acting on the body. So that little infant I was saying who's just a newborn can feel gravity.
And the word vestibular comes from
The vestibular center, the vestibular system is located in the brainstem. And if you think of the brain as a mushroom, the brainstem is basically the stem, and the cortex then is the cap. And sometimes they'll tell the teachers that you have the cap. You're educating all of that part that's put together, and us OTs, and we're building up that stem so that, you know, they know what to do with the information you're teaching them. But it needs that that broad approach. And so the proprioceptive system then is the ability of that individual to respond to gravity. So when I'm sitting here, I know my elbow's bent. I don't visually need to look at it. And now it's straight and I don't need to look at it. And that's the proprioceptors in our muscles and joints. And they're just as important as the taste receptors or the visual system, taste, touch, smell, sight, hearing. The proprioceptive system allows us to guide our movement so that if I'm that infant, I'm going to feel gravity, not like my head being squished against the floor. So I'm going to talk by way of the proprioceptors to my muscles and joints to lift my head and then eventually move towards a source of food to sustain myself. And that little connection there between the vestibular center feeling gravity and the proprioceptor responding appropriately to avoid suffocation and leading towards sustained existence by reaching a source of food is really the very beginning that starts that brain turning and turning and turning, and then ultimately the sense of touch through the feeding.
Which you call the tactile system, and I think of the three, we might understand that when we understand touch, we think.
Yeah.
Do we?
Yes.
In regard to the child with a learning disability.
Yes. Uh-huh. The sense of touch, the tactile system, exactly, is so very key and for the child's learning. So I put in this book the vestibular system being able to feel gravity, the proprioceptive system being able to respond and move your body, and the tactile system being able to touch, because these are the basic sensory system. This is the stem of the mushroom. This is the basic sensory system that really needs to be in order for that whole cap of the mushroom, the whole cortex of the brain to function well while they're sitting in their desks, learning, reading, and writing, and arithmetic. And the sense of touch is fascinating, because once the child can actually touch and understand what they're touching, then that starts the brain to organize. So we can look at something and see it and see where it's located, but once we actually touch it and it processes throughout the whole brain that how far we had to reach, what the temperature of that item was it smooth, was it sharp, that's when the brain starts to categorize. And in fact, you need that accurate sense of touch, that tactile input, to organize, to sequence, to organize your glove compartment, to organize your drawers at home. It's a sense of touch. So it all comes back to the vestibular, proprioceptive, and tactile. So many words. So I just abbreviated that. I just came up with it myself, and I'm calling it the VPT periodically throughout the book. But when the teachers can come back and go, on what level is that child having dysfunction, then we can come up with some strategies.
My guest is Reading occupational therapist and physical therapist Suzanne Cresswell, and she has written a book of solutions for unique learners to help us discover the ability in learning disability. And I am referring to learning disability, but I know the point of your book is to say we need to really not think in those terms, that we need to see the ability that these people just learn in ways that differ from the rest of us. And it's hard for us to see the world as these children do.
And so, with
the best of intentions, we tell the child, slow down or pay attention, or, and that's not the best strategy. So in your book, at the end of a section, say, for example, on ADHD, mm-hmm. that's one that people are familiar with. This child is hyperactive. So what do I do for a hyperactive child? So you give examples, you give stories to illustrate, here is a specific problem. Here's a child that had ADHD. Mm-hmm. Here were the symptoms, because we might not make that connection. We think, oh, this child just doesn't behave herself. And who did you give as examples of children with ADHD?
ADHD in my book is in Chapter 3, and I've got a child, Renisha, and an adult as well. ADHD certainly plays out in the adult world as well. And the child is an amalgamation of three or four children that I worked with in the schools, and also a couple of children came to see me in the clinic under their medical insurance, and it was a blend of their stories and their moms and parents and so forth. And for the children, the primary focus of that particular chapter was for the young child, Renisha, who's in kindergarten, first grade, to look at her as being out of step. She was out of timing. She was out of rhythm with the rest of the world. She's moving too quickly. She's moving at a different pace, and to begin to work on her rhythm and timing and sequencing, rhythm and timing and sequencing. If you recall, I was talking about sequencing and organization, and then that was the tactile center. So it gives you all kinds of strategies you might not think of.
I want to ask you more about her story, because I think it can be very helpful for the rest of us. But we are going to take a short break. And when we come back, I'd like you to tell us what the symptoms were for Renisha and what the strategy for helping her. My guest is Suzanne Cresswell, and she has written a book, Unique Learner Solutions. And when we come back from the break, we'll continue hearing what some of these strategies are. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. With school starting up again, I wanted to ask an occupational therapist and physical therapist in as a guest to help us understand the 13% of public school students who struggle to learn like everybody in their classroom learns, so that they don't feel like a constant failure. And these children often feel shame that they're not normal. And this term, learning disability, reinforces the belief that they're not able to learn. So you give an example in your book. You say it's a composite, but you call her Renisha.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And what were the symptoms that she would be disruptive?
Well, in the clinic, she would come into the clinic by entering the door so loud the door would hit the wall, and then she'd run through the lobby, and we have a staircase in the lobby, and she'd run up the stairs. And this was in tolerable and unusual behavior, according to her mom. And so her mom is scolding and kind of following her as she's dropping the toys that she had brought in with her and so forth. And yet I recognized it to be that this child needed to understand the parameters of the clinic and that she was in her fast way physically exploring the clinic so that she wouldn't have as many unknowns. And it was her way of coping and hearing the backstory before mom came into the clinic. It made sense because the mom was talking about this physically new environment. And so Renisha seemed to get the understanding that it had to do with the physical space. So that was her first thing to explore.
And so if she comes running in, a mother's first reaction would say, slow down, Renisha.
Yeah.
Don't do this. Don't make this noise. Don't rush around. But she was not understanding,
correct,
which is understandable, that she was not seeing the world through Renisha's eyes.
Yeah, and Renisha somehow had the impression that it was somehow going to be like a park or a playground or a fairground with rides. You know, she was kind of all set for that. And given her paradigm, she just blasted in and came in. So she and I toured the clinic, and I described to her all the physical places. And then we went into the area that we do the occupational therapy that has age-appropriate toys and so forth. And she handled things in an unusual way, a ball you think would be bounced, you know, just placed on a shelf, a doll that you think would be held was actually bounced, the trampoline which you'd bounce on, she'd sit, and the chair that you'd sit on, she'd bounce, and just all these unusual behaviors. And so mom just found that very difficult because mom is looking at that in terms of an adult and a child and demonstrating respect. And from that perspective, you could see that mom was reasonable in doing the best she could. Her loving attempt to parent her child, to socialize her child, to be nice to this new adult. And yet the child was really demonstrating her way of making sense of the world. It was perfect for me to quickly understand what she needed.
Well, I think, too, the mother would want to be considered. Other adults would say, why does that mother control her child? And so the mother wants to be considerate of other people, and yet she's taking the wrong approach. So what did you suggest for Renisha and her mother?
Right. Well, we started right away in working on reframing that for mom and for Renisha.
In general, a child with ADHD.
Yes.
I hear adults say they have attention deficit disorder, and I thought, really? Are they just saying that? Because I take that with a grain of salt. I think sometimes they're just labeling themselves that arbitrarily. But you, when you look at a child, you know this is the real deal.
Mm-hmm.
And so what do you suggest to the mother?
In what we worked on with Renisha is the timing and the rhythm, really. That to have her, she was too slow at certain times and she was too fast at other times. So we began to work on timing and rhythm. We actually worked on bouncing and catching a ball at a certain pace with a metronome going, and having her spell words or say colors or say the alphabet in the same time as the bouncing and catching the ball. And we worked very much on this idea of time in general, in terms of actually like holding a clock, a standard clock, and understanding what a 5-minute increment was and what she could typically accomplish in a 5-minute period of time. That became helpful for mom because mom could then say 5 more minutes, then bup, 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 bup. And so if Renisha understood what 5 minutes was, so we were teaching her about time. And
well,
space,
also, a mother would tell her to slow down, and you describe her taking fast steps was her way of keeping herself from falling. She would have to take that step in front to keep from falling.
She did. She had
that wouldn't occur to most of us.
She had an odd, her running, actually, once we started to understand her, test her balance and so forth, her running was just a controlled fall. She didn't really have that much of a choice unless she was super, super concentrating. When she was walking, she had to walk very quickly because her balance was off. So she'd swing this other foot in front of her to catch her balance, or she'd hang onto a wall or furniture. And so it, you know, it looked like this child that you classically see, you know, running with white walls and jam on their fingers and holding the walls as they go. And, you know, just this kind of nightmare child to come and visit your house sort of thing. But each one of those we could peel back. And if we looked at it from a vestibular, what's going on with their balance, from proprioceptive, how's her body responding to the gravitational pull, the Earth's surface, and the other demands physically made on her by the world. And then how is her sense of touch and how is she organizing those experiences? When we could look at it on that VPT, then we could design a program for her. So her understanding of space was off, how much space she needed to take up. Her understanding of timing was off. Her understanding, her sense of touch was off. And with all of these things misfiring, then her strategy had been to speed up, physically speed up. Now, Lynette, the adult in the classroom, her strategy was she was like running marathons like Renisha, but she was doing it mentally in this disorganized way. So she could never get to the end of a problem-solving sequence. If you saw...
Which made it hard for her to hold
Lynette's
a job.
Brain, yes, it's like she was running around the clinic. But as, you know, a 35-year-old woman, you learn... You know, the world teaches you some things. So she had learned how to physically look still and quiet. But mentally, she was running around the clinic in that same way. So it was very similar intervention for the Lynette, the adult,
the adult,
as it was for
ADHD.
Renisha. It was the same, needing to work on rhythm, sequencing, and organizing, which is ultimately time and space, and being able to... also identified the triggers that would cause Lynette or Renisha in order to become less and less coherent as they become more and more involved in a circumstance that is unfamiliar to them.
And you described this as helping the patient, if they call them that, to move from chaos to coherence.
Yes. Thank you.
My guest is Suzanne Cresswell. She is an occupational therapist and physical therapist in Redding, California, and she has collected solutions to helping unique learners. And she says that people who that we might label as having a learning disability really have talents that may go unrecognized if we only see them through our eyes, our way of viewing the world. So she encourages us to discover the ability and learning disability. So you have a chapter on going from chaos to coherence.
Yes.
With the ADHD client.
Yes.
And then your next chapter deals with autism, the autism spectrum. And the autism has been a lot in the news, and I think most people do understand it's called a spectrum because you have high-functioning and low-functioning people on this spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you suggest for—well, first of all, how do we recognize it? I think maybe people have an idea of the symptoms of autism. But how do you help the parents and the students?
Well, the individual with autism spectrum disorder will have an atypical response socially, perhaps, and they take in information frequently in kind of a broader sequence. This is a child that doesn't always fit into the learning model that involves breaking down a project and sequencing it linearly. The child with autism spectrum disorder sometimes does better with understanding the outcome and the whole general concept, and then they are able to produce that work, but it might not follow the identical steps that were set up by the teacher. And so these kinds of things become more and more apparent to the parent and the teacher that the child has this distinct way of learning. And in our clinic and in the schools, when we work with parents and teachers, we encourage them to really step back some and be the student, if you will. And then the child or adult with the autism spectrum disorder becomes the teacher. And when we move into that way of thinking, then we get to observe and see those things that that lovely individual with autism spectrum disorder, ASD, do to make the world make sense and for them to be functional. And then we also have the opportunity to see those times when things kind of break down, and I call that chaos. So just moving the child from a kind of a state of, we want them to be most functional and most coherent. And so to step back and become the detective, really, and to learn what the child is needing in their life in order to be more and more able to follow through with a classroom structure is the approach in that chapter on autism.
And you list the chief signs of, and you put quotation marks around autism, the chief signs of autism are social isolation, lack of eye contact, poor language skills, and the absence of understanding another person's perspective. And these things, and I think sometimes we don't recognize, if the person is an adult, I once, quite a few years ago, was interviewing somebody that it was quite a difficult interview, intelligent. And that's the irony. We say these people with autism have learning disabilities, but they are quite intelligent in my experience.
I would agree.
And here was this intelligent person, but he was quite difficult to interview. And afterwards, I was talking to a physician friend of mine, and he says, oh, it sounds like he might be autistic. And the light bulb went off over the top of my head. My goodness, that's what it is. And you mentioned, you suggest that parents tell the teacher that this student has a learning disability, I'm going to call it that for convenience, but not to tell the other students. And I thought, yes, that's good advice, because it instantly turned my thinking around about this person.
Right.
When this idea was planned, I thought, oh, of course. Because like I say, he was quite intelligent. It was just a difficult interview. That social interaction was difficult. So you do, I like that suggestion that the parent tell the teacher, but then the other students might change their feeling about their classmate.
Correct. Right.
So what specifically do you suggest for autistic students?
These students will require ways of assisting them in staying focused, and we have different terms for that, but a term now seems to be able to regulate them, to self-regulate, which means to be able to focus and concentrate. And at some level, regulate almost is like a mood. So you're in the right mood to read, in the right mood. So the child with autism spectrum disorder then needs to learn what it is they have to do to their body in order to stay geared up and stay focused in the structure of a classroom. And teachers will provide them with activities that allow them to keep their brain going. Sometimes those are fidgets that they have in their hands. Sometimes it's different types of materials they're sitting on to keep their brain charged.
You mentioned movement breaks. And I remember reading an article by a teacher, and I don't remember if she retired or what the occasion was, that she followed around like she was a student. And she was shocked at what we asked students to sit still hour after hour. I believe these were even high school students.
Oh, yeah.
And she said, we're asking them just to sit there for hour after hour. For goodness sakes, let's let them get up and move around a little bit, for Pete's sake. And so you're suggesting that for the autistic child.
Yes, exactly. They that's usually the first thing the teacher will notice, is that the child has difficulty managing themselves in the classroom and becomes a source of distraction for themselves and others. And that's a genuine strategy of not just an autistic child, but many individuals have what works out to be these work break cycles, where the brain can plug in, and then where the brain needs a break. And so with the autistic child, usually in the classrooms, this is how we start to work with them, is we identify what that break work cycle is. So if the child is able to function for 20 minutes before it becomes really clear that the structure is too intense, then we would work with that 20-minute successful period of time. And then at the end of 20 minutes, then the child would be allotted a movement break. And just to caution, it's not that we would over time have those movement breaks less frequent or shorter periods of time. These are fairly structured time where the brain is on and the brain is off. And instead of shortening the time that they're having their frequent breaks, is we try to have more and more complicated activities involved in their work cycles. And once we can start to ramp up the work that they are doing in that just 10 minutes or just 20 minutes before that 3-minute break. Once we can ramp that up, then we can extend the period of time that they will work. But that's the first strategy, is allowing that child that work break cycle so they have a little bit of control over the symptoms. They're not even aware of their jiggling and they're moving and they're calling out and they're coughing and so forth, but they're given a period of time. So you're not working with quit coughing or you're not working with quit tapping. You're just allowing whatever movement they need to move. Let's honor that that's a strategy they've come up with, and we'll allow that to occur at these certain safe, emotionally safe, undistracting periods of time.
And then one of your strategies, if your child or student becomes irritated or distracted by excessive noise, then provide him or her with noise cancellation headphones.
Yeah, and you see those on the campus a lot. The schools are integrating this movement education more and more and more, and the teachers have noise cancellation headsets and unusual pillows the students can sit on and fidgets, and they're just moving these into their education model. You'll see in the schools now. It's very standard.
Well, a rather well-known person that talks about her autism, Temple Grandin, and she observed cattle and put them in these contraptions that would squeeze them.
Yes.
And when might that be appropriate for a child, to wrap them in a soft blanket and actually squeeze their arms and legs?
It's a fantastic activity for a child, especially a child who has autism spectrum disorder. And the child I talked about earlier who is bumping into the desks as he or she moves down the row. Children need to understand how big their body is, how much space they take up. So do adults. That's why we do sports. That's why we walk and move. That's why we swim. That's why we do yoga. It reassures the brain as to the parameters of the body. So it's the same thing with the child with autism. When the individual Temple was, she invented what was called, a squeeze box, if I've got that correct.
Mm-hmm. And for herself.
Mm-hmm. And we have these similar models in our some of our sensory classrooms in the school districts. And the children will move through, they're like soft rolling pins, and they'll move through this series of rolling pins that will just give this gentle compression, full body, as they kind of snake through these soft padded rollers. And that full body compression hits the tactile center, hits the touch center, and also hits the proprioceptive center, the center that allows the brain to begin to feel where the body is positioned in space, and receiving a hug, an appropriate hug if you're the kind of person who does well with hugs. Not everyone does, but you know that feeling. It's very grounding. Or after yoga, after moving with gravity, it's very grounding. So it's same for these individuals with the movement breaks and also with the squish. So we'll have them squish their hands and do a squish, squish, squish all the way up their arms, maybe cross their arms across their trunk, give themselves a hug. There's another cute one where you just squish your earlobes and squish up the ears a little bit. And and really what we're stimulating is the proprioceptive centers. And this is what Temple, it's a contribution that she's made for our understanding of strategies to help these unique brains.
Well, some of these students are quite young. You have an age range. There was a little bit older student named Logan. And he was actually rather good looking, but he felt inferior.
Yeah. Yes. And Logan, right, he was, a tall, handsome middle school, high school student and so forth. But yeah, he was acutely aware of being different than his peers and found that incredibly lonesome as he matured in years. And he was able to advocate for himself and talk to his teachers about this concern, and the school responded, as schools do, and supporting him. And he is actually now starting a social group at his middle school and his high school. And so it's a structured way for students like himself to get together during lunchtime and during recess time and have the school psychologist there or the speech therapist there, just to test reality, just really they have trouble knowing the line. Should I tattletale? Should I? A lot of times it's very black and white. You know, you're not supposed to lie, and yet this child said it was his pencil when it wasn't. Should I tell the teacher? These types of things are difficult. Sometimes that gray area for a child who has that social difficulty, typical of ASD, autism spectrum disorder.
Well, when I read his story, I thought, yeah, I can see why these kinds of students would attempt suicide.
It's lonely.
Yeah, you were just saying he felt that loneliness and that isolation.
He was in the cafeteria, and I think I wrote in there it was the cafeteria workers actually at the school who brought it to the school's attention because he was reticent to leave the cafeteria at the end of his meal time, and he was isolating. And so to me, it was a lovely example of how the school came through, you know, and everyone is there to support one another.
I thought so, too, that the cafeteria workers were, and you used the label detective. You said, be a detective. You encourage the parent to rather than want to be judgmental and correct and chastise, you say, just observe.
I do.
Be a detective and pay attention.
I do. Yes, because it's a lovely thing to imagine that the child, your child or your student, has what they need to be successful, to adopt that belief system. And then it becomes the adult's role to support, nurture, so that that child, that blossom, if you will, can open it in its most natural way. And by observing this lotus blossom open, if you will, then it provides you with an opportunity to see where assistance is needed. And it is driven then by the child, and it's very meaningful. We start where the child has skills. Today, before being here, I was visiting at the Red Hen store, and talking there about a gal who works at that shop was describing how she will meet her clients and the individuals with disabilities who participate in that program at their area of strength. And then from there, you can teach them other things, but to continually be trying to impose information on a child in a way that they're not able to make sense of, then the child naturally begins to become distracted and have more and more greater behavior problems. Where being a good detective, being a good observer, that parent and the teacher, and seeing where that child's gifts are and starting at that point and moving. Okay, I'll give a concrete example that just happened, you know, an hour ago at the Red Barn. We were looking. This client has great difficulty learning, great difficulty reading and writing, but it's fantastic if you give her some manipulatives in order to make these beautiful artistic patterns. So this would be an individual that the parent or teacher would probably start with those manipulatives. And since she was so able to make a beautiful tree and a garden picture out of these mosaics, then that would be where we would start. Right, okay, let's shape the letter one, and then letter A, and number one, and number two, and we would use these, her strength, so she'd be in a point of self-confidence and feeling mastery, and then we would superimpose some new learning onto that. So we'd start where they're already feeling a sense of mastery.
My guest is Suzanne Cresswell. She is an occupational therapist and physical therapist in Reading. And her book is Unique Learner Solutions, Discover the Ability in Learning Disability. You know, you're helping us to see the world through the autistic, for example, if that's their situation,
yes.
The eyes. And I'm so often seeing it from the parents' eyes because it can be so heartbreaking. I've read stories of what a single mother, for example, goes through with an autistic child. And it's so heartbreaking what they go through. And yet you're helping us see, well, it's tough being the child, the student.
It's tough being the
autism child.
Yes, it really is. Uh-huh. Yep.
Well, after your chapter on autism, you have two chapters, one on gross and fine motor problems.
Yes.
And so why do you divide those into the gross motor problems and the fine motor problems?
Excellent.
Or skills.
Sure. The gross motor challenges would be the individual who has difficulty managing the large muscle groups. They're having good balance. They have difficulty with that. They have difficulty with sports and activities. And they have trouble following rules. These are the children that are on the playgrounds, maybe separating themselves from their peers. They don't really know what to do with a hula hoop, and they don't really know what to do with a basketball, and they don't know how to play the wall ball games and so forth. And these children have a lot of difficulty organizing their brain and body in order to be able to participate in a classroom situation. But certainly the unstructured recess and PE time offers a great deal of stress for them as well, when they don't really know how to be operating their body.
And then your chapter on the messy printing syndrome, poor fine motor skills.
Mm-hmm.
And what can we do to help children in that situation?
Yeah, well, it's very similar, really, to this child with the gross motor challenges who's having difficulty on the playground at recess and in PE. And then they're coming back into their classroom, and they're trying to use now the small muscles in order to do the very fine writing and reading that needs to happen, using their eye muscles in a very discerning way, using their finger muscles in a very discerning way. And they don't have that information moving into their brain very well to be able to do that efficiently. They're having to really concentrate. The development of the hand muscles is so dependent on our infancy. Really, we would start grasping and releasing as infants, just holding kind of full gripped hands, grasping with all fingers and thumbs. And then as we roll onto our tummy, we get more familiar with crawling. We're getting weight bearing through the hands. Then the hands get an impression on the motor cortex, so the brain and hand connection is greater. So for the child who misses crawling, then it becomes difficult for them to have those small muscles working well for writing. So very often when we have difficulty with those small muscles for writing, we would be teaching the children weight-bearing activities with the hand, and blending it all together with the gross motor.
Well, I think people might not have a child directly in their family, but we all encounter people that have these problems, if I want to call them that.
Mm-hmm.
They have abilities that we may not see if we only see the problem, the disability. So thank you for writing this book, Suzanne.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you, Nancy.
My guest has been Suzanne Cresswell. She is a Reading occupational therapist and physical therapist, and her book is Unique Learner Solutions, Discover the Ability in Learning Disability. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.